This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for May 2008. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we highlight poems and articles in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poetry from Jane Hirschfield.
There is no kindness here, no flint of mercy.
And from Chris Dombrowski.
Stitched with wing sound, a feathered hush.
But first, we wanted to tell you about some other things in the issue.
As our regular readers will know, the magazine's divided up into two parts. Poems in the front and prose commentary in the back. Let's talk first about the prose this month.
You know, Don, one of the things that I loved especially was this notebook from Evan Boland, the Irish poet Evan Boland, who writes in this notebook a lot of different entries about wondering sort of what is a poet, how does a poet emerge. He says, who exactly is a poet? How do we recognize one, even when circumstances seem to deny the possibility of such an existence? And I thought of my own background. I grew up in a very small town of West Texas where there certainly weren't any poets. You grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, right?
Yeah, I didn't know there were living poets.
Yeah. So I think it's part of an education as a poet is sort of learning that the place you come from can be a place for poetry. And that was Evan's experience.
One of the things she raises is, among other things, what kind of skills is a poet supposed to have? She says these days poets are supposed to be skill-based, know how to do things, conduct themselves professionally, perform in certain ways. But then she gives examples of poets you couldn't imagine having these skills.
Right. She says to think of Patrick Kavanagh, who's an Irish poet that I admire a lot, or Charlotte Mew, an English poet, leading workshops or flying to a strange city to give a reading is to stumble straight into anomaly. You know, I guess the popular image of the poet is a long-haired, wild man raving about, unable to hold down a job.
And that's exactly what I thought.
Right, drinking tons. And
Then I saw Allen Ginsberg, the first living, breathing poet I ever laid eyes on.
Well, he was a pretty good exemplar of all those characteristics, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Maybe he had a little bit of each of these things that she talks about. He obviously had skills, knew how to get along and make an impression on people, but also he was a little out of the box.
Well, Evan talks about how, with the increasing professionalization of poetry, that she wonders whether poets who fall into that category, sort of the wild bards of the past, might not have a place, not find a place, and whether we value the wrong things in poets.
I like that she's going to ask our readers to think about this as well, because it helps you figure out where poems are coming from.
Another interesting prose piece is this exchange that we asked two young poets to participate in.
You never know what's going to happen when you get two poets in a room together, in this case, Kate Marvin and Joshua Meegan. And what we do is we let them each basically review a book, and then they go back and forth about it and switch around the other way. So here, Kate Marvin is talking about Alice Oswald's selected poems, and she didn't know what to think when she looked at the book and found herself becoming a fan of Oswald's work. And at one point, Kate says, when I'm allowed to look in on the haphazard and dangerous moments of decision-making, well, that's when I find a poem to be most alive. And Joshua chimes in right away.
He
basically says, well, this is quoting Joshua. Well, to be perfectly honest, I found poem abnormally clumsy and melodramatic.
It's a good way of getting at the heart of these poems. It's particularly effective, actually, when poets can disagree.
They get a good dialogue going about this in which some good questions are raised. And these competing viewpoints here balance out really nicely. So I think people will enjoy reading it.
Don, before we hear Jane Hirschfield and Chris Dombrowski read their poems, was there one more that you wanted to look at?
Yes, a poem that stuck with me in the issue is Seth Abramson's poem, Provincetown Fourth. One of the things this poem really gave me so nicely was a picture in my mind of the place, and it was a different picture from the one I actually had in it already. That's a good thing a poem can do. Provincetown Fourth. Here we are in our doughboys and camos, our dotty frocks with drips of bitter on the sleeve, our passions revving their pulp to pittance at a gas station in the city that never peeps. And here is the city with its Martians in leather and excoriated thunderbolt boas, its Bible trippers, its vintage bazookas for barter, not sale, its reluctance to be reluctant, its speed for hire into which we atrophy ourselves to briefly fit. And we are never so close to the joys of oil, the grease inside which a fat becomes a fit, as we bellow magnanimously praise on the least well of those who pass. Ones who are dying, we salute. We are coming from the war. They are going to the war.
It's a very striking and strange image of soldiers watching a flamboyant gay parade, presumably.
Yeah, but it's nice that this poem tries to knit all these things together, that there isn't really a distinction, though visually you might think there is, between the way people look in our country walking around the streets together and what we project around the world with whatever force we have and whatever the consequences may be. There are casualties everywhere.
Yeah, and the poem makes a nice, completely unsentimental connection between the soldiers and the people in this, well, I don't know if it's actually a parade, but in the crowd.
I couldn't imagine someone describing it better, Martians in leather and excoriated thunderbolt boas.
To turn a quick corner, we have other poems that are sort of political in this issue, which went together, and one of these is called, oddly enough, Colonoscopy Sonnet by Sandra M. Gilbert. On the news tonight, a presidential colonoscopy, a tale of how for 3 whole hours the chief exec of trouble handed trouble to his vice, although no double trouble came, but then no more details revealed, no bacterial armies multiplying in a flare of war among kingly polyps and no kinky creases. Welcome to the presidential gut, bubblegum pink, not a spot of shit, after a quick administrative clean-out, where global decisions stir and sit in state, and the first physician's mighty pointer traces only microdrops of blood in secret places. And this is a very different sort of poem in that it's playful until you get to the end, and suddenly you realize that there's a political jab buried in the poem.
Yeah, it nicely addresses the ever-popular question of, you know, what's too much information?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, it's funny because it is, in the medical sense here, too much information, but the point of the poem is actually how little information we get about what's going on. It's almost like the deeper you look into the workings of political culture, the less the information seems to be meaningful.
That's a great way of putting it. And of course, the metaphor there is, you know, of course, where we're looking for this information is a, a dire place.
And the way it's packaged and
right, exactly.
Formed.
Yeah. Many of the poets in the May issue are being published for the first time in poetry. Chris Dombrowski is one of them. He lives in Missoula, Montana, where he works as a fly fishing guide, and it's hard to tell exactly where the poem we're about to hear is set, but the wilds of Montana would be a pretty good guess, wouldn't you say, Don?
Yes, it's a poem called Landscape with Scavengers and Bone Light, and one of the pleasures of the poem is trying to parse out what this landscape consists of as the poem unfolds.
Here is Chris Dombrowski reading Landscape with Scavengers and Bone Light.
All day the ravens shit the buck whitetail back onto his antlers. The thick arcing tines graffitied with undigested tendons. Coyote dragged, draped in a squawking garment that rises tattered when red-tail harried, revealing ribs, links of spine, tongue-clean sockets, and falls in patches back, stitched with wing sound, a feathered hush, says you will go down in the dirt. First the four-leggeds ferrying your shape across the slough, yipping nothing resembling a name. Large birds then, like lamp-drawn moths, before the six-limbed elders arrive as one mind, as shifting soil, to polish what's left, forsaking only the inedible brain.
Well, that's a striking image. The six-limbed elders arrive as one mind.
Yeah, that seems like the ants are marching on this roadkill.
It's great. We think of elders as the elders of a tribe or the bearers of wisdom of a culture. And here the bearers of wisdom are the most mindless, determined, timeless sorts of creatures.
Yes, eating up whatever's there. But sort of with one mind, which is, I suppose, one way of looking at how the earth operates with its shifting soil. But not only are they elder and wise, they perform the nice function of polishing what's left in this poem, except that they forsake
not
the inedible
brain.
Forsaking only the inedible brain.
Well, I remember when this came in, remember we puzzled over that. And that seemed to me kind of, well, lazily metaphorical, because it just seemed a way of making a metaphor where one didn't exist. And so I queried him, and he said, no, in fact, they will eat every part of you but the brain. They won't eat the brain, and no one knows why that is.
Well, it's melancholy and yet grotesquely cheerful.
Yeah. Jane Hirschfield's work has appeared many times in poetry, as well as in many other magazines. She is a Buddhist, and her poems have a contemplative, sort of hyper-attentive feel to them.
The Pear, the poem that you'll hear in a moment, starts off very simply. It's November, and there's one pear swaying on the tree. But gradually, you get to understand that it's about somebody who has been losing his mind.
We asked Jane to introduce the pear, and here's what she had to say.
This poem was written after visiting a dear friend who continued to write poems of enormous power, depth, and transparency long after his diagnosis of Alzheimer's. By the time of this visit, writing was long over for him, but as you can tell from the words I quote in the poem, which are exact, his fundamental graciousness, intelligence, and eloquence were completely indestructible.
Here's Jane Hirschfield reading The Pear.
November. One pear sways on the tree, past leaves, past reason. In the nursing home, my friend has fallen. Chased, he said, from the freckled woods by angry Thoreau, Coleridge, and Beaumarchais. Delusion, too, it seems, can be well read. He is courteous, well-spoken, even in dread. The old fineness in him hangs on for dear life. My mind now? A small ship under the wake of a large. They force you to walk on your heels here. The angles matter. 4 or 5 degrees, and you're lost. Life is dear to him yet. Though he believes it his own fault, he grieves. His own fault, his old friends have turned against him, like crows against an injured of their kind. There is no kindness here, no flint of mercy. Descend, descend, some voice must urge inside the pear stem. The argument goes on, he cannot outrun it. Dawnlight to dawnlight, I look. It is still there.
When I first saw those lines, and especially descend, descend, first thing that popped into my mind was Frost's provide, provide. Better to go down dignified with bought and friendship at your side than none at all, provide, provide. I don't know if it's an allusion to that at all, but it might be, considering that Thoreau, Coleridge, and Beaumarchais is also sort of chasing itself around the mind of this fellow in the nursing home.
It's interesting that compared to the last poem where the ants were compared to elders, or the insects were compared to elders, the sort of energy that lasts here is inside the pear stem, and it's that same sort of compulsion to grow and die and go on. It's just an endless sort of change.
It's the kind of animal structure of things, too. Here, for instance, where the crows turn against an injured of their kind, the mind turning against itself, blaming itself. But the mind is always changing, and eventually it deteriorates. So it's funny to think that a pear has a kind of substantiality that our own minds may not have.
Yeah, it's moving, a moving poem. She has four new poems by Jane Hirschfield. The Pear is just one of them. Here's another one.
All the difficult hours and minutes. All the difficult hours and minutes are like salted plums in a jar. Wrinkled, turned steeply into themselves, they mutter something the color of shark fins to the glass. Just so, calamity turns toward calmness. First, the jar holds the umeboshi, then the rice does.
That certainly sounds Buddhist to
me. Oh, it certainly does. Yeah, I love the way you take a detail, the plum, salted plums in the jar, and then juxtapose it with an abstract statement, calamity turns toward calmness, and let the one sort of suggest the other and ramify against mm-hmm. the other. It's very clearly influenced by Asian poetry.
And yet I can't help thinking, and this is probably something I shouldn't be thinking, that there's a conspiracy of illusion here where, you know, when you see plums in a short poem, you think of Williams. When you see jar in a short poem, you think of Stevens.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's true. So
this poem sort of sneaks up on you with all of this because it's really it is related, I think, to those poems, even if it isn't relying on them.
You can read all four of Jane Hirschfield's poems and everything else you heard on the podcast in the May 2008 issue of the magazine and on our website, poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is produced by Curtis Fox and Ed Herman. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Christian Wyman.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.